You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2. The National Socialist Movement. In a race-based nationalist state, the school must set aside more time for physical training. It is not acceptable to weigh down the young brains of students with heavy loads of book learning. Experience has clearly shown that these students will remember only a small fraction of what they are exposed to, and the part they do retain usually consists of unnecessary and trivial facts instead of the essentials they will need for later life. The young person is not capable of sifting through the mountain of material and separating out the important from the unimportant parts in this sea of knowledge poured into him. Today, the secondary schools only schedule 2 hours a week for gymnastics, and even those 2 hours are not mandatory. This is a glaring imbalance of the importance between purely intellectual and physical training. A single day should not go by without the young person's body being trained for at least an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. This training should be in all kinds of sport and gymnastics. One sport in particular that must not be forgotten is boxing. Many racialists regard this sport as brutal and vulgar. The current false opinions in cultivated circles about boxing are quite astonishing. If a young man learns to fence with a sword and then goes round dueling, it is socially acceptable and even considered honourable. But for him to box is thought to be rough. Why is this? No other sport approaches boxing when we look at how it builds up aggressiveness, demanding lightning-speed decisions and training the body in strong agility. It is no rougher for two young people to fight out a difference of opinion with their fists than with a piece of sharpened iron. The man who defends himself with his fists when he is attacked is not less honourable than the man who runs away, yelling for a policeman. Above all, the young, healthy boy should learn how to stand up to hard knocks and rise again when he is beaten. Naturally, our present-day intellectual warriors regard this as savage, but it is not the purpose of a race-based nationalist state to breed a colony of pacifists who are more interested in appearances than substance, or to breed physical degenerates. The state ideal is not the honest lowbrow or the virtuous old maid, but the defiant individual representing manly strength and women who can bring strong men into the world. Sports exist not only to make the individual strong, agile and bold, but also to toughen and teach people to endure the difficult world around them. Our entire intellectual upper class was exclusively brought up by being taught the refined lessons of manners. If they had all learned to box instead, a German revolution consisting of dandy men, deserters and rabble would never have been possible. The revolution was made a success by the cowardly, miserable indecision of those who guided the state, and its success was not due to the bold and courageous energy of the revolutionaries. Our entire intellectual leadership had been educated with intellectual weapons and was defenseless the moment the adversary picked up a real physical weapon. The revolution was possible only because our schools of higher learning preferred to train civil servants, engineers, technicians, chemists, lawyers, literati, and did not train men to be real men. They were more concerned that they would run out of professors. Our intellectual leadership has always been brilliant in itself, but when it comes to willpower and accomplishment, our leadership has been beneath contempt. No amount of training will make a coward into a courageous man. It is equally certain that a man with some amount of courage may be paralyzed in his development if his education is inferior from the outset, and does not encourage his strength and agility. The confidence one gains from physical excellence greatly increases a man's courage and even awakens his aggressiveness. This can be judged best by the army. Our military men were not all heroes here any more than anywhere else. Overall, they were average. But the superior training given to the German soldier in peacetime injected the giant military being with a hypnotic faith in its own superiority, and this faith was built up to a degree its enemies never thought possible. The immortal spirit and courage displayed by the onrushing German army in the summer and fall of 1914 were the result of the tireless training through the long, long years of peace. This training led men to achieve the greatest of deeds, and out of feeble bodies it produced a self-confidence that was never lost, not even in the horror of the greatest battles. Our German people are broken and crushed. They lie exposed to the kicks of the world, and they need the hypnotic strength inherent in self-confidence before they can restore themselves. This self-confidence must be trained into the young members of our people from childhood. Our children's entire education and training must be planned to give him the certainty that he is absolutely superior to all others. Through building his physical strength and agility, he must retain his faith in the invincibility of his entire nation. What once led the German army to victory was the sum total of the confidence that each soldier felt in himself and the soldiers' common confidence in their leadership. In order for the German people to stand on their feet again, they must restore their conviction to reconquer their freedom. This can only be achieved when conviction exists equally in the hearts of the grand total of all the millions of our people. We must not allow ourselves to be deceived in this. The collapse of our people was overwhelming, and the effort to bring this agony to an end must be equally overwhelming. Anyone who believes that our people can obtain the strength to shatter the present world structure and throw the broken chains of slavery in the faces of our enemies from our present privileged class education, which teaches us peace and good order, is bitterly mistaken. This path would lead to our destruction. Only an extra dose of national willpower, a thirst for freedom, and the utmost passion can correct what we have lost. Even the clothing youth wear must be suited to this purpose. It is sad to see how our young people are already subject to a fashion madness that does its share to turn the old saying, "clothes make the man," into a disastrous one. Youth is the time when clothing must work for education. The boy who wears long trousers and is wrapped up to the neck in summer loses any desire for physical exertion because of his clothing. To solve this problem, we must appeal to ambition and vanity. Not vanity of fine clothes, which obviously not everyone can afford, but vanity of a beautiful, well-formed physique, which everyone can create. A strong body will be useful in later years too. A young girl must have the opportunity to become acquainted with her knight. If physical beauty were not completely pushed into the background and hidden by our fancy world of fashion, the seduction of hundreds of thousands of girls by bow-legged, disgusting Jew bastards would not be possible. It is also in the best interest of the nation that the most beautiful specimens should find one another and help create new beauty for the nation. This is more necessary than ever today, because military training is no longer required. That was the one institution that at least partly compensated during peace times for what the rest of our education system failed to do. And now it is gone. The success of military training was not exclusively in the development of the individual, but in its influence on the relations between the sexes. The young girl prefers the soldier to the civilian. The racial state must not only carry through and supervise physical education during the official school years, but must also take responsibility after school is completed. As long as a boy is still developing physically, this development needs to be encouraged, and it will be to his benefit. It is nonsense to think that the state's right to supervise its young citizens immediately terminates with the end of school life and suddenly resumes during military service. This is a right just as much as it is a duty. the present-day state, which takes no interest in healthy people, has criminally neglected its duty. The current state policy allows young people of today to experience damnation on the streets and in brothels, instead of maintaining control and continuing their physical development until they become healthy men and healthy women. At this time, the state cares nothing about continuing this training. What should be important is the goal to make these training regimens a reality and research the best methods for such training. The race-based state will also have to consider the intellectual training and the physical development of post-school years as the state's job and maintain this training through state institutions. This education can be the preliminary training for later army service. The army should not have to teach the young recruits the simplest drill instructions. At this point, the military will no longer receive recruits as such, but they will simply turn the already physically trained young man into a soldier. In the race-based state, the army will no longer need to teach the recruit how to stand and walk, but its job will be that of the final and highest school of training for the fatherland. The young recruit in the army will receive the necessary training at arms, but he must also be molded further so that he is prepared for his later life. The crowning point of military training must be that which was the greatest merit of the old army. In this school, the boy is to be turned into a man. In this school, he must learn to obey, and through this experience he will gain the fundamentals which will later enable him to command. He must learn to be silent when he is rebuked justly, and also learn to suffer unfairness in silence when it is necessary. Fortified by faith in his own strength and carried away by the intensity of esprit de corps, common morale or team spirit, he must become convinced of the invincibility of his nationality. When he has finished his army service, he is to be given two documents: his diploma of state citizenship, a legal document which permits him to enter into public life, and his health certificate, proving his physical fitness for marriage. The racial state can also carry on the education of the girl using the same principles as the boy's training. The main emphasis must be placed on physical lifestyle above all, secondly on the development of spiritual and mental aspects, and lastly on intellectual beliefs. The unshakable aim of female education must primarily be on her future as a mother. The second consideration of the racial state must be to foster character building in every way. Of course, the most essential qualities of character are already present in the individual person. The man who is selfish will always remain so, and at the other end of the spectrum, the idealist will always be an idealist. But in between those extremes, there are millions of people who seem to have vague and indistinct characters, and they can benefit from such education. The born criminal will always be a criminal. But people who have a limited criminal inclination can still become valuable members of society through proper education. On the other hand, bad training may create truly bad people from those who were previously only indecisive characters. There were many complaints during the war about the fact that our people could not keep their mouths shut. This weakness made it very difficult to keep the enemy from learning important secrets. We must ask ourselves the question, what did the German education system do before the war to train individuals to be discreet and keep quiet? Unfortunately, even in school, the little tittle-tale was often favored over his more discreet comrades. Then and now, gossiping is regarded as praiseworthy frankness and silence as shameful stubbornness. Did anyone make any effort to represent discretion as a manly virtue? No, because in the eyes of our current school administrators, these values are of little importance. But these trifles cost the state countless millions in judicial expenses because 90% of all lawsuits for slander are caused solely by a lack of discretion. Irresponsible statements are blabbed about without considering the consequences. Our economic life is constantly harmed by those who recklessly reveal important manufacturing techniques. the secret preparations for national defense are turned into an illusion simply because the people have not learned to hold their tongues, but are happy to talk about everything to anyone. In war, this easy-flowing chatter may lead to the loss of battles and contribute to the disastrous outcome of the overall struggle. We must realize that if the youth are not taught something, they will not do it when they are older. That is why the teacher must not try to find out about silly boyish pranks by encouraging unpleasant tattling. Youth forms a mini-state of its own and faces the adults with a certain solidarity, which is perfectly natural. The bonds between the 10-year-old and his friends of the same age are stronger than those with adults, which is also natural for children. A boy who tells on his friends is betraying his friend, and when this tattling suddenly occurs on a large scale, it exposes a nature that is equivalent to high treason. This kind of boy cannot be considered as a good, well-behaved child, but as a boy who lacks the quality of character needed to care about others. It may be convenient for the teacher to increase his authority by making use of such failings, but a spiritual seed has been planted in this youthful heart that may later have disastrous results. It frequently happens that a little tittletale has grown up into a great villain. This is just one example. There is no deliberate effort to develop good, noble qualities of character in the schools today. In fact, they practically teach against them. In the future, a much stronger emphasis must be placed on this kind of character-building education. Loyalty, self-sacrifice, and discretion are virtues which a great people must possess. The teaching and repetition of these values in the schools is more important than much of what students are taught today. Breaking the habit of complaining, tearful whining, and of howling when hurt, etc., would also come under this heading, and must be taught as well. If an educational system forgets to start out by teaching the child that even pain and hard knocks must be handled in silence, it must not be surprised if at some later crucial moment, like when the man is at the front lines of battle, the entire postal service is devoted exclusively to delivering whimpering and wailing letters filled with complaints back and forth. If there had been little less knowledge poured down the throats of our children in primary school, and a little more self-control, that effort would have been rewarded from 1915 to 1918. In its educational work, the race-based nationalist state must attach the greatest importance to character development along with physical development. Many moral disorders in our present political body can be lessened, if not altogether eliminated, by proper moral education. The development of strength of will and determination, as well as the development of a willingness to assume responsibility, should be of the utmost importance. The army has a principle that a command is always better than no command. With young people, this should be taught as an answer is always better than no answer. Not to answer for fear of saying the wrong thing should be more embarrassing than to give an incorrect answer. Starting from this primitive basis, youth must be trained to have the courage to act. There is a common complaint that in November and December of 1918, every single person in authority was revealed as a failure, and that no one, from the monarch on down to the last divisional commander, had the strength to make a responsible decision on his own. This terrible fact is the handwriting on the wall for our education system. The cruel catastrophe of 1918 was the result on an enormous scale of what already existed on a small scale all around us. It is this lack of will which makes us incapable of resistance today, and not a lack of weapons. It affects our entire people and blocks every decision involving any risk. No great decision can be made which does not involve great risk. A greatness of a deed consists of its boldness. Without knowing it, a German general succeeded in finding the classic formula for this pitiful lack of will when he said, "I act only when I can count on a 51% probability of success." The tragedy of the German collapse is found in this 51%. He who demands a guarantee of success from fate renounces the significance of a heroic deed. Heroism exists only where one is convinced deadly danger is a condition of action, and one still takes the step which may perhaps bring success. A victim of cancer, whose death is a certainty otherwise, does not need to calculate a 51% chance of success in order to risk an operation. Even if this operation offered only a 0.5% chance of success, a courageous man would not hesitate to risk surgery, and if he chooses not to take the risk, he should not whimper for his life. Our present disease of cowardly indecision and lack of will results mainly from our incorrect education during our youth. The devastating effect of this education error continues into later life, finding its conclusion and its crowning form in the lack of moral courage seen in our leading statesmen. The same source produces the cowardice that rages today, and it can be seen when one is faced with responsibility. The origin of this mistake can be traced back to the education our youth receives. It saturates all of public life, and is immortally perfected in the institution of parliamentary government. Unfortunately, even in school, instructors attach more importance to remorseful confessions and to the promises not to do it again by the little sinner than they do to an honest admission. To many a popular educator today, the honest admission is considered to be a sign of habitual delinquency. As incredible as it may seem, the prophecy of the gallows has been foretold for many a young boy simply because he displayed some of the qualities that would be of great value if they were common among all of our people. The race-based nationalist state of the future must concentrate on training the will and the decision-making ability in our youth. Beginning with infancy, the state must implant the idea in the hearts of our youth that one should be ready to accept responsibility and to make an honest confession. Only if the education system recognizes this need and how much the impact will benefit the nation, and then only as the result of centuries of education, a national body will exist that is no longer subject to those weaknesses that disastrously contributed to our present collapse. The state's educational job of academic school training can be taken over by the new race-based state, which only needs to make slight modifications. These changes are in three fields. In the first place, children's brains should not be burdened with things they will not need or with things that they will forget. Almost 95% of what they are taught is forgotten. The classes taught in primary and grammar schools are in an unusual mixture. In many of the individual subjects, the volume of materials to be learned has increased so greatly that only a fraction can be remembered, and only a fraction of that can be used. On the other hand, what is learned is not enough to train a man to make a living in a certain trade. Take, for instance, the ordinary civil servant who has graduated from secondary school or from the upper secondary school. When he is 35 or 40, he is tested to determine how much school learning remains, knowledge that he once so painfully acquired. Then we see how little of all the stuff that was drummed into his head can be remembered. One answer offered is, maybe, but the purpose of learning so much was not simply to instill tons of information for later use, but to train his memory and his thinking power and his brain's ability to reason. This is true in part, but still there is a danger that the youthful brain may be drowned in a flood of impressions that it rarely has the ability to master, and the child cannot filter or judge what is of greater or lesser importance among the individual elements in that flood. On top of that, the essential parts of knowledge are the ones which are forgotten and lost. The unnecessary parts of knowledge are retained. Therefore, the main purpose of learning so much is lost. The brain cannot be made to learn by dumping unmeasured piles of educational instruction on it, but it can learn by supplying it with knowledge which the individuals need for later life. Through him, then, society benefits. The justification for the current method is misleading, because when such an excessive mass of material is thrown on a person in his youth, In his later life, he retains none or only non-essential parts. I see no reason why millions of students over the course of years should be forced to learn two or three foreign languages that they can only rarely use. Languages they mostly forget. Out of 100,000 pupils who learn French, for instance, scarcely 2,000 will have the chance to use any of this knowledge later. The other 98,000 never use it in their entire lives. Children spend thousands of hours learning something which has no value or meaning to them later. Even the objection that this is part of a general education of the mind is false. This claim would only be valid if students retained what they learnt throughout their lives. So it is really for the benefit of the 2,000 people who will use this knowledge of the language that 98,000 are weighed down with useless information and sacrifice valuable education time. Also, the language I have used as an example, French, is not one that gives training in logical thinking like Latin does. It would therefore be much more appropriate for students to learn only the general outlines of a language. Provide the student a simple sketch of the essentials that would give him some knowledge of the characteristics of the language, and perhaps introduce him to the origins of grammar and illustrate pronunciation and sentence structure by examples. This would be enough for average students, and it would be easier to understand and retain. Ultimately, it would be more valuable than the usual method of cramming the entire language into a student's mind, especially when the language is never really mastered and it's later forgotten. We would no longer risk that only a few disconnected fragments of the overwhelming quantity of materials would by chance stick in their memory. This way, the young person would be given only the most noteworthy parts to learn, and only the important aspects of the language would be taught. The basics of a language would be enough to last most people the rest of their lives. Anyone who really needed the language later would have the basic understanding to build on, and by his own choice he could practice and learn it thoroughly. This would make the necessary time available to schedule physical education and for the increased requirements in the fields already mentioned.